Hey, and welcome to the Inside Public Accounting Podcast. I'm Chelsea Summers, Executive Director of Inside Public Accounting. And today I have a guest who's doing things a little bit differently. And I'm excited about this conversation because it connects to so many of the themes that we have been covering this season. The talent pipeline, how firms are positioning themselves, and what it actually means to build a sustainable practice in today's environment. Rachel Ferris is a CPA and the founder of a boutique firm specializing in high net worth tax strategy and advisory work. She is recognized as a Forbes Top 200 CPA, a Forbes Top 50 in state, and was recently named a CPA Practice Advisor 40 Under 40 honoree. She started her career at a Big Four, focusing on mergers and acquisitions, and has since built her own firm with a very clear and intentional niche. She serves high net worth individuals and entrepreneurs with complex tax needs, including Puerto Rico's Act 60 incentives. And she didn't stop there. Rachel's also the founder of Tax Stack AI, a business focused on helping small and mid-sized firms adopt AI using custom solutions that help to make new technology feel practical and also revenue generating rather than just in the theoretical. Rachel also works with Becker Professional Development, working on developing curriculum and instructing. She's someone who's really rethinking the profession from the inside out. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Chelsea. I'm really excited to talk today.
Yeah. So you have made a very deliberate choice to go deep in a specific niche, those high net worth clients, the Act 60 strategy and complex compliance. So a lot of firm leaders talk about specialization, but they really struggle to commit to it. What made you willing to narrow your focus that much? And what happened when you did?
Yeah, well, I realized I couldn't do everything. I think that's a hard thing to admit for a lot of people. But I realized I was a one-woman show for the most part, right? And I couldn't handle everything that people were throwing my way. It was causing issues in my personal life. I was feeling stressed. I felt like work was taking over every ounce of my being. And, you know, I really do love work, but that's not entirely who I am, right? And so because of that, I really wanted to focus where I could not only provide the most value for my clients, but also get the most time value back in my own life. And so I decided to focus. Obviously, there's pushback. There's a lot of experimentation. I always like to say it's not plan A, it's not plan B, it's another iteration down the road, especially when you're finding a specific focus that you're really going into. Overall, though, through time, I found it was a really positive reception because when someone's looking for a specific service and they resonate with you specifically, that client bond is so much stronger than if they can shop around and they can find it from any other accountant on the block or any other financial advisor. And so because of that, I've been able to really build deep relationships with the people that I work with. I mean, they comment on my LinkedIn posts. They are so excited when they see me doing well because they see themselves as a direct buy-in to that process versus just seeing themselves as another number because I'm a generalist. So it's been a really positive experience.
That's so interesting. And you've written a lot about how trying to serve everyone can create some invisible friction in a firm. So it's got inconsistent delivery, diluted messaging, operational complexity. So for managing partners at larger firms who really feel locked into being generalists by their existing client base, what's a practical first step towards specialization?
Yeah, so I actually started being selective about new clients that I took on. I think that's the easiest way to start. I think it's overwhelming. I need to get rid of all my clients at once. We're going to cull everyone, right? And I don't think that's realistic because you actually don't know if your niche is going to work until you actually give it a shot. And so I find some unfortunate scenarios where people dive head first in, right? And they think it's something that people need and people, yeah, I would totally pay for that. But it's not actually something they pay for when it comes down to it. And so I think it's really important to have that backing of an actual business still. So, you know, start taking on selective clients. You know, you don't need to get rid of everyone immediately. Once it really works, then I started having candid conversations with the existing client base about the direction that I'm trying to move in and saying, hey, is this something that aligns with where you see your company or you see your personal situation aligning with as well? Now, I want to be really clear here. Don't leave them hung up high and dry, right? Like you want to make sure that you have options for them as well. I think just focusing on yourself and saying, yeah, you've been my client for 10 years, but I'm actually going to drop you because I'm focusing on this is not great for business. You know, make sure that you're working with their next CPA. You have someone in mind. You have recommendations. Let me do introductions. Let me get them up to speed on your situation, because a big fear clients have is, well, you've known me for that long. Like, yes, I don't, you know, I don't want to move to Puerto Rico, Rachel, but I still want someone that knows what's going on, right? You want to make sure you're able to pass that knowledge and learned experience onto someone else. And just because you're pivoting doesn't mean your clients always need to pivot with you, but it does mean that you need to provide them with other options. So I think that's a really good way to, again, I think a big messaging thing here is people first, focusing on people first and focusing on making small steps. It's not an overnight change. This could take you a couple years, but it's important to stay true to it. I think a lot of people say they're going to specialize and then it's 4 years down the road and, you know, they're still keeping that on. You need to make tangible steps, you know, set benchmarks for yourself. You know, by this time next year, if my revenue with my specialized clients has hit this amount, I am going to phase out X percent of my generalist clients. Like, come up with different ways that you can hold yourself accountable so it doesn't always just seem like you're pushing it to a future date to deal with.
When you're describing that, I almost feel like it's a snowball. You start with a couple steps and then it goes a little bit farther. And then I'm sure as you get deeper into that niche, you're getting more referrals and that snowball is growing and growing until next thing you know, you have a giant snowball of the incredible firm that you've created.
100%. That is a really great way to see it. And I think it's a great way for it to feel less risky. I think people are afraid to dive into such a niche, right? But if you can see success, right, and you can see it opening up and that there's more possibility and you're getting more people coming in and maybe you don't even have capacity. Like, our firm doesn't even have capacity for new clients right now, right? That shows that you've hit on something that's actually working. And once you kind of get to that spot, then you don't have to worry about the general stuff as much and you can do something you're passionate about. I'm going to throw in an extra thing here. I think your niche should be something that you're passionate about, that you actually find interesting. I think, again, sometimes people get stuck in a specialization because, well, I just happen to do a lot of nonprofits. Like, it just falls into my lap. It's just what's happened. Well, that's really great if you love it, right? But if that's the work you dread doing, that's not something I think you should focus on, even if that's naturally what's come into your lap. When you're doing it day in and day out, you need to make sure you actually enjoy that process of it, not just because it fell in your lap and it was like, well, there's no one else to do it, right? Make sure you actually find interest in it because you're going to be doing that for a long time.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to talk a little bit about the talent pipeline. The data we look at IPA, it paints a sobering picture of the pipeline. And you have been vocal that this is not just a hiring problem. It's really a structural and a narrative problem in the profession. So what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, accounting is so diverse, right? And it's so flexible. And I think oftentimes we paint a very single tone picture of it. You know, you talk to anyone in accounting and generally like the first thing they say is, oh, the hours. And I think a lot of times we equate our worth or how well we're doing in our career to the amount of time we're spending. It's almost like a badge we put on our chest, especially in public accounting, you know? And because of that, that is inherently a narrative problem when people of all ages, right, are hearing, hey, I'm working so much. And yeah, like in the industry, we kind of know it's a joke, but it's kind of not a joke, right? It doesn't seem very attractive to people. And that really dives down to the structural basis of it as well, right? We have this culture of, you know, hours. We have this culture of, you know, putting all this time and energy and it's a dreary career. You know, you only did it because you're making money or whatever it might be, right? At the end of the day, it needs to start from the tone at the top, right? If we have leaders that are pushing that narrative and we have systems that push that same narrative that aren't actually fostering a culture of flexibility, cooperation, you know, diversity, then how do you expect people to feel attracted to that? A lot of times people, you know, I hear things, oh, they're being poached by investment banking. It's a pay issue. It's a this issue. It's a that issue. They want more PTO. It's not a single issue. It is a structural issue at the base. It's a systemic issue. And those are kind of band-aid issues that come out of that systemic issue. So just because all of a sudden, you know, pay has increased, right? Well, I mean, I don't think proportionally the amount of people interested in accounting has increased. That would probably be my guess, right? And so you have to start looking at things as like, yeah, maybe that's what they're telling you the issue is, but it's a lot deeper than that. We have so many subconscious things that we think of when we think of accounting that we really need to start reframing.
We've talked about that a little bit on the podcast, that we're really all responsible for the story of accounting and telling those stories and highlighting those opportunities and highlighting the small firms and the large firms and all that's available, and not just what is the narrative right now as we're 2 weeks post-tax season. Oh my gosh, tax season's over. That was so awful. Worst tax season I've ever had. Like, there's so much positive out there. We just need to be better about raising those voices.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%, 100%. And I think, you know, there are people out there that are doing really great things with that. But I think, again, it goes back to individual responsibility. You know, you're responsible as a single person, right? Just because you aren't, you know, the managing partner at your firm or you're not a senior manager, you still have a voice. You have people you interact with all the time, whether it's siblings, cousins, you know, maybe you volunteer at a local university, whatever it might be, right? And the tone you're setting about the profession is what they are hearing. And ultimately, I mean, I'm sure there's people in it, not because they actually enjoy it, just because of other things. But if you actually have things you enjoy about it that have made you stay this long, talk about those too. You know, work doesn't always have to be complaining. I think there's, you know, times and spaces for that. You're still going to hear me complain about it, right? I'm not saying it always needs to be, you know, roses and all that. But I think it's important to paint an actual realistic picture. And a realistic picture includes the positive things as well.
Absolutely. So you've talked a little bit about engaging students earlier at the high school and the university level and how that can help change the story around accounting as a career. So what do you see that actually works when you get in front of those students?
Yeah, well, especially at the high school level, I always like to say, what do you think an accountant does, right? And I like to hear kind of what the preconceptions are. A lot of times it's, oh, it's numbers. They're really good at math. I'm just like, that's not me, right? Really good at math. They sit behind a computer all day. Like, they're old, right? And they're not very social. And I think those are a lot of the sentiments I get. So then I try to use that preconceived notion to talk about what it actually looks like. So I think telling personal stories and being real about it is important. You know, I tend to walk people through what my career has looked like and the opportunities it's provided me and why I actually really like it, because it's giving me the flexibility to eventually have a family. Or, you know, I even say, I'm here talking to you on a school day. Like, who else has the flexibility where I can just drop off, right? And tell my clients, you know, I'll get back to you tomorrow because I'm here with you presently. And so, because of that, being really candid about the whole experience and talking about what got me interested and what got me to stay, you know, talking about, I'm actually really bad at math. You know, I'm actually sitting behind a computer less than you'd actually think. Talking about what that actually looks like, I think, is really important. And then also showing different career options. I love to run little like case studies and simulations talking about like, hey, this is a business and all these people have these different, you know, characteristics and different job functions. Like, which one of these do you think accounting plays into? And you'd be shocked at how many of those roles people actually have an accounting background, or even giving examples of big CEOs out there and big name people. And I'm like, fun fact, they were actually an accountant. That was where they got their start. And so when you start opening it up and you show how it's really the language of business, people get a lot more excited when they don't think it's just a traditional pathway of either filing tax returns or auditing a company. Yes, it looks like that for a lot of people, but it doesn't have to if you don't want it to. So I think that's something that kids are really relating to. And I've even had some people reach out to me saying they decided to concentrate on it in university because of what they heard from me. And that sounded like a lifestyle that they wanted to live as well.
Well, how powerful is that? You know, I think as firms are pushing into more advisory, that sitting behind a computer, running numbers, doing tax returns, we're going to need less and less individuals. So it is really imperative that we change that narrative so we get those right people that go to school for accounting. We don't just need the good at math, sit behind a computer people. We need problem solvers. We need people who are client facing, who are comfortable in the soft skills, you know, and that's not typically what individuals think of when they, you know, sign up to have a career in accounting. So I think it's great that you're helping to change that narrative because we need it now 100%. More than ever.
Yeah. I mean, even at the education level too, right? I think some schools have gotten up to speed with what they're teaching, but I think oftentimes you do need to learn the fundamentals, right? But it's only learning the fundamentals at a university level. And so even kids, once you get them in the door to study accounting, they're like, this is so boring. Like, we're not doing anything that I find interesting. And I've slowly found, like, my old university, you know, they're actually adding in things that we use. Like, hey, we're going to learn all tricks. You know, we're going to learn some cool, like, you know, Tableau. We're going to learn new technologies. That makes it feel more applicable and feel more relevant to, you know, young people that are using technology. And so I also think that's a really important thing. You know, education needs to step up as well. People use that as a trial almost for what a profession looks like. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times, you know, we focus too much on meeting those hour counts. And, you know, there's some good changes that are happening around that. But in general, I think that, you know, it doesn't frame accounting of what you're actually doing in person. I think, you know, I don't think I did too much in university that exactly mimics what I do today. So that is also as important.
We know many of you listen to this podcast on the go, driving to work, working out, even doing chores. Now you can get CPE credit for that time. With Earmark, you can earn free NASBA-approved CPE for listening to the Inside Public Accounting podcast. After you listen to an episode, take a quiz, and your certificate will be ready. Earmark has courses for everyone in your firm, from staff to partners. Get started today at earmark.app or download the free app on the App Store.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about how you hire. So what does non-traditional hiring look like inside of your firm? And what led you to move away from the conventional recruiting model?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love a flexible lifestyle myself. I would say I don't work a 9-to-5 usually. And I set that precedent with my clients where, you know, they know I reply to things very quickly. But they also know that, you know, I might reply to them at 7 p.m. I might reply to them at 6 a.m. It really just depends on the day and their personal need. And because of that, my kind of natural need for flexibility has attracted, and I've also been looking to attract, you know, people, expectant mothers, recent mothers, retirees that still want to keep something going, right? Anyone who wants flexibility, but still wants to work. And I find that accounting really does offer a lot of flexibility as long as you establish that with clients. You know, I get the energy all the time. You know, I was in M&A for a while, private equity. They need it by the end of today. They need it by the... Maybe then it feels a little bit different. But when you're working with small businesses, with people, I find that it's generally not a next day thing. Like, it can wait, you know, a day or two, give you time to do research. Like, I am not pressed at getting to you by end of day unless it's actually really important, right? And because of that, we're able to attract really high quality talent that would have normally been excluded from that talent pool, right? You know, I know a lot of big firms say, hey, it's part-time, but that part-time actually looks like full-time because hours are always inflated. We're talking about real part-time. We're talking about you work on your own hours as long as you get things done in a timely manner. You can decide when you want to work. And it's really, really, really allowed us to move away from that conventional recruiting model. I find that you're getting people that want to stay with you and they feel invested with you. It's not a quick buy-in, you know, pump out in 2 years, right? It is something where they are invested in the long-term growth of the firm. They're invested in your clients more and you build more personal relationships because you're also investing in them.
Right, exactly. So when you're bringing in somebody from outside of a typical accounting background, what does onboarding and development look like? And do you see big gaps when they're coming in? If so, where?
Yeah. So I always like this quote, you know, you can't really teach people interpersonal skills, but you can teach people technical skills. And so I find that I hire based on a person, right? I hire based on a work ethic, a curiosity, you know, the ability to critically think and problem solve, not necessarily how many years they've had in accounting or what scores they got here or what school they went to or what degree they got specifically, right? And I find that that onboarding process looks like more teaching people how to use their critical thinking and problem solving skills when they don't know something, how to learn that technical knowledge rather than just being like, okay, well, you need to come in with X many years of experience so that I don't have to do anything for you. You can just handle it on your own. No, this is a collaborative process, right? I want people that are going to grow into their roles and grow past their roles even. I'm not looking to hire someone just to match a role at a specific point in time. And so because of that, I hire based on who someone is versus what they actually know. And I found that to be really successful. I think that, again, more and more onboarding development needs to focus on that. They need to focus on building people's skills. They need to focus on building, how do you think when things go wrong? Again, we're not a traditional 9-to-5, right? If your manager is busy, you need to learn how to actually figure that out yourself or, you know, wait around and be productive until you can get them at the table. I find, again, a lot of staff, well, they haven't replied to me all day, so I'm not going to do anything, right? I'm not looking for people that do that. I'm looking for people that are almost entrepreneurial in a way. And that's been really helpful to find that as like a core characteristic rather than just being like, you need to have a CPA to work with me.
Yeah, I love that. So compliance work is really getting squeezed from multiple directions. There's automation, tons of competition, client expectations are changing. So how have you structured your pricing and what has the client response been?
Yeah, so we do primarily like 95% of our clients are on fixed yearly billing. And the client response has been really positive to this. The way that I really like to frame this is, you know, we are providing change, we're providing transformation. We're not just filling out a tax return and leaving you there. And so because of that, we don't really like to nickel and dime clients. We like to be able to be there for you when you need it. And we don't want to say, hey, we're not able to cover that because that wasn't in our direct scope of what we were doing. And so because of that, we, you know, look at the size of the firm. It's not even an income level thing. It is literally like, how complex is this engagement going to be? I have, you know, startups that are making $0 in revenue that are much more complex than, you know, a family that has, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars under assets. And I charge the startup more because of the fact that it's more complicated. And so because of that, you're able to really provide unique services and you are able to be there for them in a way that, you know, doesn't feel weird, right? I can use AI. I can, you know, I can bring down billable hours. I'm not worried about, hey, you need to clock all your hours and make sure you're spending enough time, but not too much time on this client, right? Do things as you need to do them. If I underestimated it, that's on me. That's for next year for us to talk about, right? It's pushing the burden off of us a little bit more and putting it kind of in an equal playing field where we're not worried about, hey, Rachel, you spent this many hours doing PDF review. They don't need to know how long I spent on PDF review. I don't need to break it out line by line. I like to provide updates in general, what we are doing. And I don't need to break it down to the 15-minute increment of how I spent my time on you. At the end of the day, you should be happy with what we are providing at the end of the day, the end work product, the relationship you have with us. And I think it's hard to put a specific hourly dollar amount on that. So it's become a lot more fruitful. And I think honestly, clients are kind of expecting it nowadays too. I think more and more people like that fixed hourly billing, especially when it comes to advisory. I do think it's a little bit harder when you're talking other services, but with advisory specifically and compliance, it's much easier because you never know what's going to come up.
Yeah, you say clients might be expecting it, but the IPA data shows that only 67% of revenue is still generated through a charge hour model. So what do firms do? What do they typically get wrong? How you know, we talked a little bit about how you're moving your clients, the specialized clients, like one at a time and only new clients. Is that how you would advise switching into a value-based pricing or what can firms do?
Yeah, I mean, I think first is changing the narrative, right? You need to talk about the value you're providing, that transformation you were actually generating, and not just a line-by-line list of what you do for them, right? Because if I'm a client and I have someone come to me and says, okay, I'm going to do your return this year and we're going to do this, and it's the same stuff you did last year and it's broken out line-by-line, I'm going to say, well, what's the point? Why are we switching billing models? The only reason we're going to switch is because it's benefiting you, and that means it's probably not benefiting me. And so you need to really position yourself in their shoes. You know, why does it benefit them? Is it more flexibility? Can we assist in more areas? Is it so we're not nickel and diming them? Like, what does that actually look like for you? And why are you making this change? You really need to explain that why. I always like to start with, you know, this is the package that we offer on a general basis, but every client is different. And talking about how this is more actually individualized than doing an hourly basis type of thing. When it comes to actually bringing clients into that, doing fixed billing, again, start with new clients. And then after that, I usually like to have conversations with existing clients about, you know, hey, this year, you know, we did these things outside of, you know, our general realm of what we would do. Like, this is actually what it would have costed you if we did do things on an hour or fixed basis versus an hourly basis. And hey, you know, we're trying to be more accurate, bringing AI tools in XYZ, right? This is what the work's actually going to look like. Now, here are additional services we are now going to be able to provide for you, you know, open things up to them. And I find that people are very receptive to that. I think the pushback is less from clients. You know, you talk about that percentage of, you know, firms that are actually offering that. I think the pushback is actually, from what I've been hearing anyways, more on the firm side. Again, we attach a lot of our worth to the hour. We attach a lot of our time, energy, what we're actually about. You know, I have a $500 hour billing fee. You know, we attach something to that, right? And it's what we're used to. And so while clients might actually see benefit in this fixed pricing plan, I think sometimes we're worried about letting that go, or we're worried we're going to underprice it. And then I think in my mind, that just goes down to research. And that also goes down to actually knowing the work we're providing. You know, maybe spend the next year actually focusing, okay, what are we doing? What do I think that's worth to them? And instead of carving out an arbitrary number, make sure that you feel comfortable with it too. Because if you're not confident in what you're offering and the price point you're offering it at, they're going to feel that same energy from you, and they're going to sense that doubt too. And it might not be as successful as you think.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about how AI is changing the work. So you founded TaxStack AI. So you saw a specific problem. Firms wanted to adopt AI, but didn't know how to make it practical and profitable. So what does responsible AI adoption actually look like in a smaller mid-sized firm?
Yeah. So, you know, our firm, you know, we help firms adopt AI ethically, responsibly. We use custom solutions. And our big guiding point here is it's human focused. And so I think that's something we tend to lose a little bit with this. You need to look at the issues first, and you need to talk to people about what they actually need. I think, again, we live in a world where sometimes we guess, right? We guess what clients want. We guess what specialization we should do. We guess what people will pay for, but it's not grounded in anything, right? I always like to start boots on the ground with easy wins. You know, what is actually going to help your existing employees and your existing clients? We do research. We like to scale slowly. A lot of people are adopting 5 different tools at one time, and they don't actually understand it. They don't understand the constraints of AI. They don't understand how the tools work together. They don't have literacy in that technology. And I find that that's not responsible AI adoption. I think it's important to scale slowly. I think it's important to train your team, not only how to use AI, but when it's appropriate to, what is a hallucination, right? How do you actually check that work? And if you're not doing that training with your firm before you adopt tools, I don't think that you're doing that responsibly. I think that's something that you're going to burn out in a year or two, or a new tool is going to come on board, and all of a sudden they're relearning a whole new tool versus understanding just how to learn to use AI, right? I think a huge difference with small and mid-sized firms is that a lot of times you are not having, you know, these huge, huge, huge seminars with people, and you're not having an internally based tool that's, you know, specific to your firm where they have direct parameters. A lot of times you're kind of building those parameters as you go, and you're doing it collaboratively versus in a big firm that's coming from the top down. And so because of that, you need to engage the people you're actually working with to understand how it's going to work. If you're a small firm and you only got 2 people on board and other people aren't going to do it, you haven't adopted AI in my mind at all, right? And so because of that, right, again, it's people focused at the base, right? You need to talk to clients. You need to talk about where they're actually having issues with you. And once you get that, you'll be set. But again, understand the constraints. That is like my big thing here. A lot of people don't do that. And I think we're seeing, you know, more and more cases pop up where people are having issues with that. Get that education. And if you're not able to get that education yourself, you know, bring someone on board that does have that background that can help you out. I understand it's scary, but it's doable.
Yeah. I so appreciate your time today. I've got one more question for you before you go. So can you give some advice to managing partners? If you could tell managing partners one thing that they need to look out for when building the firm in the next decade, what would that be?
I mean, I'll go back to what I said. Approach everything with a people-first mindset. You know, and clients, employees, contractors, literally whoever. People drive profit. And if you're not investing into those around you and you're not investing into yourself, you're not building everything you might want to be in, you know, like the next decade or whatever it is. You need to focus on who's actually been here for you this whole time and who's helped you build the business or build the person that you are, and focus on building your firm in alliance with your own beliefs. I think sometimes, you know, we get sidetracked, you know, shiny money, things look really nice there. But at the end of the day, it's not sustainable, and these new tools aren't sustainable if you don't have people that are invested in using them, and they don't have people invested in you. So no matter what, you know, keep this people-centric. I know we have a lot of hype about AI. I'm hyped about AI too right now. But at the end of the day, I am more hyped about my employees. I know more about what's going on in them and their lives than I do about the AI tools that we're using. And I think that is very fundamental to what makes me a good leader and what's going to help me run a successful firm decades from now. So that would be my suggestion to everyone.
Wise words. Rachel, this was such a good conversation. The way you're thinking about the design of your firm, talent, and pricing, it connects so much to what we're seeing in IPA's data and what we're looking towards for the future. I think it's one thing to talk about specialization and advisory, and it's another thing to actually build your firm around it. And what stands out to me is that you're not waiting for the profession to change. You are leading the change. And you're actively helping to reshape it in your firm through TaxStack AI and the work that you're doing with students coming into the pipeline. I really think this is the leadership that the profession needs right now. So if you want to learn more about Rachel's work, you can find her at rachelferriscpa.com and check out the TaxStack AI as well. We'll put links in the show notes for you to check out all of it out. Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chelsea. This was a great conversation.
Yeah. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed today's conversation, please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a comment. We love hearing what topics you want us to dig into next, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Inside Public Accounting Podcast. Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can click below to subscribe and check out more from Inside Public Accounting.